Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
So, guys, we're here once again to have a chat about a film in spoiler-filled detail, as we often have done. What is the film this week? It was your choice, Jamie. Tell us what the film is.
Okay, the film choice for this week was The Matador from 2005, directed by Richard Shepherd and starring Pierce Brosnan in his probably most not Pierce Brosnan role that maybe I've ever seen him in. It's about a globe-trotting hitman and a crestfallen businessman who meet in a hotel bar in Mexico City in an encounter that draws them together in a way they neither expected. And it's basically, yeah, Pierce Brosnan plays a washed-up hitman who's having a breakdown. He bumps into a businessman whose life has fallen apart, and it's kind of like a Cable Guy type situation at the start, where like he can't quite get rid of Pierce Brosnan, and then they fall in love, I guess. I don't know. I don't know how else to describe it. Pierce Brosnan has a moustache, and then later in the film, the businessman played by Greg Kinnear also has a moustache.
Look, it's straight in with the spoilers. Good work.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about wearing the moustache later.
Okay.
It's a bit of a throw forward there. I guess, I mean, have we mentioned enough of the people who made this thing?
Directed and written by Richard Shepherd. It's got, as I said, Pierce Brosnan, Greg Kinnear, and then for the most part, a lot of people I'm not really sure like who they are or what. Like, there was no one.
Who
There
played
was,
Bean?
yeah, I think it was Hope Davis.
Yes, it was.
She's Bean. That's a yeah. That's
Well,
weird,
her
isn't
name
it?
is actually Carolyn, but yeah.
But why'd they call her Bean?
I don't know, it's just a nickname that she has.
Okay. Well. Anyway. So, I guess we should talk about our expectations before we came to this one. You know, what made you pick this one, Jamie?
Well, I saw it. I remember it being advertised back in like 2005 when it came out, and being intrigued then because, like, probably a lot of people who grew up mostly in the 90s, I know Pierce Brosnan as James Bond. And even though, like, most of his James Bond films are rubbish, apart from GoldenEye, he. What?
No, I agree with you,
It's
but
true, like.
let's just review all Bond films that he did
Well,
there.
but. No, but what I'm saying is that he was very good as James Bond, and he made an impression on the character and on the series, and that's where a lot of people know him from. So post Bond, you know, like 2 years or 3 years after he did Die Another Day, which was the last one he did, he takes on this like completely different character who is in some ways almost like a spiritual, not sequel, but like a spiritual continuation of where the character of James Bond could end up, because
Well,
he's,
I
you know,
follow
it.
you to an extent in that he's a paid assassin and Bond is sort of that as well, but he definitely burst away from the typecasting of
Yeah, but
Bond.
it's the kind of toll that you know, relentless death and sex and alcohol would have on someone, and that's very much what it is. Like, he's not, his character in this is never, like, he's likable. But he's a mess, and it never hides the fact that he's a mess. Like,
Well, that's what I like it for, is that it's like Bond, but like they're not pretending that it's actually okay to be someone who drinks and kills people and has a lot of sex.
there's a lot of stuff really wrong with him, and he's really suffering for it, and he's lonely and a bit pathetic, and he's trying really, really hard to be cool. And Pierce Brosnan pulls it off incredibly well. And I watched. I didn't finally see it until maybe last year, I think. And I went in. I didn't really know what to expect because it didn't seem to have any kind of reputation behind it. Like, it just came out and nobody cared. So then, when I was very pleasantly surprised then when I actually watched it and enjoyed it right the way through. Like, it never started to meander. It never got dull. There was enough of a plot, but it wasn't. It's not plot centric. Like, it's far more about the relationship between the two characters and about Julian, who's Pierce Brosnan's character. It's very, very character driven, which is probably not what I was expecting. I was expecting more kind of like, I don't know, like maybe Beverly Hills Cop type thing.
Sure.
But, you know, a bit darker.
Okay. Well, we'll address some of those points. What about you, Abby? What were your expectations coming into this one?
Well, I heard of this via you. And just based on the title alone, The Matador doesn't really appeal to me because I have problems with bullfighting.
It was hard in your youth when you were forced to do it, wasn't it?
I was going to say, are your problems with bullfighting that you're not very good at it? Or
I have a disagreement with practice.
Is it the spangly costumes? Because that is a fashion faux pas.
But once I actually watched it and realised that it wasn't about it, it intrigued me very quickly. It took like single figure minutes before I was, oh, this is actually really good.
Yeah, I mean, it opens with a bullfighting scene, so you must have been like, oh gosh. But after that, I mean, it gets up and going pretty good. Like you mentioned, I kind of put you onto it, but I've seen this before. Jamie, you know, suggested it to us, but I guess that was why, you know, it was like, oh, like, yeah, let's do that film, because I already like the thing. But yeah, I caught the trailers when it was out, and I thought it looked kind of good. I checked it out. Like you say, there wasn't much fuss for it, I don't think. And I really enjoyed it. And so, you know, it was nice to check it out again. I mean, I already had it, so it was no, just stroll over to the DVDs. Here we go, pop it in. So, yeah, I think we've kind of spoiled the fact that we all kind of like it. So if you wanted us to rag on it for being not James Bond, then that's not going to happen. But let's get into the meat and veg of it all. Is that a phrase? I don't think
not
that's
really.
A phrase.
You almost said meat and two veg then.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, in its own way, would have been fitting for the way Julian talks.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. I almost want to throw out any comparison to Bond, because I think he's much more of a goofball, and he's less charming. Like, there's that kind of mojo that Bond's supposed to have, even though lots of the Bonds don't really convincingly show that. But
the great thing about Julian is he thinks he has it.
Yeah.
Like, especially at the very beginning of the film, like, he does believe he's, you know...
cool.
Just really cool, and it never presents him as bad at his job, but then it quickly kind of falls apart, and he's confronted with the fact that, oh man, I'm a mess, you know, and again, it's portrayed very well. But because he's, like, immediately presented as a little bit deluded, it makes him kind of adorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And poor just thing. Some of the stuff he says is so Burke-y, and he's wonderfully crass, and he just ruins every nice moment he ever has with anyone. So he's a very interesting character, and I don't really think of Bond when I watch this film. I just think of any story about a kind of anti-hero hitman and a kind of realistic-ish portrait of someone who does a lifestyle that involves contract killing, because it makes you insular, and it, you know, you've got, you know, he just is a man without family and friends, so
it's also the fact that, like, he obviously has to entertain himself a lot because he's got no one. And the very beginning, the introduction that we have to the character sets him up so well, where he's in bed with that woman and he looks under the sheets just to kind of check her out, you know, and be like, yeah, fair play to me. And then goes through her bag and finds her nail varnish and paints his toenails.
Yeah. That gave just that. Maybe
just
have
for
such a flashback to Reflections in a Golden Eye, and I thought this is going to be about another guy just doing weird stuff on his own, isn't it?
Yeah.
A weird reference, Abby, that I understand because we've watched some Marlon Brando's, but Reflections in a Golden Eye did not come to my mind. But it is a nice. There's so many little things throughout this film. It's littered with things that develop characters, and kind of, I don't know, I mean, it's essentially not just the story of a hitman. It's about his, white collar. What's the term for someone who works in, like, stuff that's office-y? Is that white collar?
Yeah, that's white collar, I think.
He makes friends, essentially, with a guy who's on a business trip to Mexico. And it's about their relationship and the breakdown that this hitman has. So it's kind of... it's balanced by a guy who's kind of completely middle American, pathetic, kind of average, you know, I don't know, I'm finding hard to describe.
It's just,
I like to think of it as two ends of a seesaw, and how yeah. Julian weights it so heavily in one direction.
Well, Julian
says... But
then
Danny weights it the other way.
Jumping ahead to the end of the film, but Julian does say at one point when he refuses to do the favour for Danny, he says he likes him because he's the complete opposite of him.
Yeah.
But they're, like, and it's presented well in that they're both in the same, or both in very similar situations, and one helps one out, or kind of helps one out at the beginning, and then the situation is flipped, and he helps Julian out at the, in the, in a similar way at the end.
Yeah.
So it's like the same scenario played out twice, but with two opposites of the same type of person.
Yeah, so it's just a kind of unusual... I don't want to say buddy movie, because it's more awkward and tense and strange, and it's not a buddy movie per se, but it is a story of two friendship developing in an unlikely way and through a breakdown of a hitman. So it's an interesting tale. I mean, you know, as hitman stories go, it's a nice change of pace. Usually they're focused on the job and they're meant to be ultra cool, but this one's a look at the psychological aspect of what it might be like to be a contract killer, isn't it?
That was one of the things I really liked about it, is the way that they visually represent him having a mental breakdown.
Yeah.
And just the way that he sees himself in the crosshair and he's seeing himself as a kid.
All the general odd little hallucinations that he keeps having. And
yeah. And how on paper, they really could have gone either way in terms of the way they... the outcome came out. It could have been really weird and sort of cheesy, but they really nailed it as just a good representation of his mental state.
It's, even though it's obvious, it's quite, those scenes are quite downplayed. No massive attention is drawn to the little like stabs of surrealism that happen. They just happen and then the film moves on.
Yeah, there's just there's one scene where he's seeing like one of the people he has to kill as himself as a little boy, and it's quite nicely done. There's a nice transition involving a mirror, and it's a creative little insert to give you an example of his psychological state and suggest sort of Freudian problems with having been a live fast, you know, party hard,
yeah,
hooker purchased hard. What's the term?
I think that comes under play hard.
Yeah, but having that life of someone who's got lots of money, has to do quite a brutal thing, and has nothing to do with his time other than, you know, find little Greeks. So it is very interestingly done. And I think another point, before we get into more of the plot, one of the other things that stands out for me is the directing is quite visually bold. Lots of bold, striking colours. Lots of matte, solid colour being used, like in the backgrounds of shots, and large, like text to, like whenever they go somewhere in a different country, yeah, big old bold letters come up and kind of fill up the screen. And it's a really interesting and striking visual style. What did you guys make of it?
Generally, it's a, even though the story's quite simple, and you know, for a movie about us, you know, essentially about a hitman, there's not a lot of blood or death or anything. But it's still very visually striking. It's very colourful and energetic, because, like, combined with the quite short runtime, it's like an hour and a half. That's why it never seems, even though there are quite long scenes where it's just characters, because it's directed the way it is, it's got so much energy that it never seems to slow down.
I was going to say that they really use the colour of Mexico.
Yeah.
To bring things out as well. Because so much of that was just what Mexico looks like anyway. And they just had to key into that and show it nicely.
Yeah, they have some beautiful shots all around different places. But Mexico is one of the places they stay for the longest. And it is just the bold paint that's meant to make slums look a bit nicer and stuff.
Yeah.
And hotel lobbies, they're a little bit too gaudy. And it's really got a beautiful and strong aesthetic. And a very, like, kind of poetic look to some of the other stuff as well. Like they have the footage they have of bullfighting is quite beautiful and used to sort of highlight as a metaphor some of the stories being told, and you know, it's very creative. I think it's one of the one of my favorite, like, just well directed cinematography, high standard movies that's just like really good without being too showy.
It never goes overboard. It never draws attention to the technical aspects. It just uses it to keep your attention.
Yeah. One of the other elements that I think was quite strong was the music. It uses a lot of popular music to throughout the film. It uses score a little bit as well, but it has some very key scenes and montages, quite like popular songs. Stuff like the jammer used at the start, and like... there's a montage that I love, and it changes the song forever. And it's Tom Jones' It's Not Unusual is playing, and it's just so upbeat and cheery. And it's a montage to kind of contextualize Julian's character. And the words all just line up with all the imagery to sort of subtly change the meaning of the song to being a bit more depraved and weird. And that really worked for me. And throughout, it's got these interesting song choices. I think Asia are used at one point during like a buddy moment, you know?
Mm.
Just like the heat of the moment. Just, just what a song to choose. That's so bold and like, oof. Abby, what did you think about the music?
I think they didn't all match up to each other like a lot of soundtracks try to do, I did really feel like I was listening to the inside of Julian's head.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just how stuff like that does just roll through. Like, nobody plays Heat of the Moment, but everybody knows Heat of the Moment. And it's going to go through there at some point.
Yeah, it seems like a contrast, but, you know, if you pay attention to what's happening and what the movie's trying to tell you, it does fit as well as lots of scores do to the moments. What do you think, Jamie? Do you like the music in it?
Yeah, and it's like you were saying, there's not necessarily any consistency if you just look at the track list.
Yeah,
it's just all these like fairly mismatched songs, but for the times that they're chosen, they are like pretty much just perfect.
Mm.
I think it might be that someone has like listened to the songs and gone, do you know what, these songs, the lyrics in them, they fit with my, like, they've interpreted the lyrics and the songs to the characters that are written and kind of matched them up. And it's something you don't, not anyone would just put together. It's something, you know, you kind of, someone must have had to see themselves and join them up. And it creates an interesting kind of tone and context, I think. Like, there's all kinds of interesting songs being used. I think at the end, it kind of finishes with The Killers. And again, the lyrics just line up in a way that you can interpret the lyrics with what's happening and get more out of the film. So I think it's like rewatchable for some of the subtler elements of it as well.
Ooh.
Yeah, but enough praise. Let's... So, you know, what can we talk about really? Because we can't just go into the whole story, but I think we need to cover more of what happens in it. You guys think of anyone want to talk about maybe something in the start to kick us off proper?
Ooh, I've tried hard this week, and I've actually got more sort of things that overarch the film in general.
We started with Nail Varnish of a Prostitute. We've set up Julian as being this weird hitman who's bored of life. What happens next?
Well, the catalyst for him seems to be when he realizes it's his birthday and he'd forgotten himself.
Yeah.
Which it comes right after a great scene where he's at that little shooting gallery in Mexico, and he's like eyeing up these clearly, like, I don't know, 14, 15-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Which I liked because it, like, in no way does it say this is a savory guy. Like, yeah, this guy is pervy and he's kind of unpleasant.
Depraved man.
Yeah.
It is that he's constantly flirting with any vaguely attractive woman throughout. He's very much living his life how he wants to, and it's, you know, uncompromisingly perverted, I guess.
Yeah. I like that he occasionally drops hints as well that it's not just women, it sometimes can just be anyone.
Yeah, there was one weird moment where he, I can't remember where he said he'd been, but he said, all of the men look like women. It's amazing. Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he's just like, he's pansexual. Like, he would just...
I like to think of him as generally morally pliable.
And he's crass and open about it, and not ashamed of himself. Occasionally apologetic in the company of women, but fundamentally he's just, you know, he's not keeping that part of his life a secret. It's literally, I'm me, you know, I'm going to be weird, and you're going to accept it.
I was just going to say the first meeting between him and Danny in the bar after he's gone out to celebrate his own birthday at some kind of underground sex or fetish club. And there's the bit where, you know, Danny starts talking about his... Because Danny and Bean had a son who they lost, was it four years ago, I think?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And Danny starts to, like, reveal that to Julian and you know, and then Julian starts telling a joke.
Particularly
about
horrid joke.
Yeah,
that we don't know the punchline to.
No, I know, and he says it's a good one too, but we never find out. But
then... something involving midgets and swizzle sticks and. Yeah.
But when he apologizes, he says, "I'm drunk and I've been fornicating for the last 2 hours." It's like it's that kind of I don't care who knows kind of thing.
Yeah, it's not bragging rights. It seems just open. He's open about his own excess.
Yeah.
It's sort of this whole primitive thing about Julian, is if you're going to be so primitive that you kill people, you can be so primitive that you have sex all the time, and so primitive that you tell everyone about it.
Yeah, so, and this is the key, this is the start of the film, really, is when he meets Danny, and Danny's there, like, kind of stressing out and drinking at a... No, a business meeting's gone well, hasn't it, at that
point? Yeah, he's celebrating at that point.
Him and, like... The brother from Step Brothers is his partner in business. Like, interesting connection. But yeah, he's at the bar and they meet. And it's awkward, but Julian is kind of looking for a friend or someone to, like, listen to him because he's, you know, alone all the time. And he inflicts himself on Danny, gets into conversation. They bond, he ruins it. They rebond. It's, and I keep saying bond, even though I don't want to reference James Bond anymore. I don't mean it that way. You know, that is the start of their relationship. And Danny, at many times, almost tries to run away because he's, like, confronted with this scary weirdo. And then every time, Julian just about wins him back by a sort of apologizing and you know, just almost charming his way back into the relationship, really, isn't it?
This is where Julian kind of, like, it's like he's trying to win the audience over too, because he's acted awful and has not been put across as in any way, you know,
sympathetic.
Yeah. And now he's suddenly like, oh, please, just please give me a chance. I really need a friend because I don't have any. And, you know, he's pleading with the viewer as well as with Danny. And you kind of think, oh, bless.
Yeah. And that then leads on to them going to see a bullfight together, which kind of, I guess, gives some backstory for them both to hear about, you know, so they learn about each other as, you know, as the bullfight happens, they're chatting. And that's kind of the next significant moment, I'd say, wouldn't you?
Well, it's where he reveals to, or Danny gets out of Julian what it is he does.
I have a side note, if we can just do that quickly.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
They don't really show killing in this movie, which I expected. You don't see them killing the bulls. You don't see them killing the people, really.
It's mostly implied, isn't it? It's kind of... It's just a snapshot. More of a hint than it is. It's not gory, really, in any way. And I guess, you know, professional, you know, executions are kind of meant... They're not going to be an overly drawn-out thing. It's going to be one minute you're there, next minute you're not, and then the killer moves on, you know, I guess.
I suppose the significance of it isn't the act in this film; it's the effect that it has on Julian.
Hmm. I was just going to say I really liked it, Karen.
One of the things that I might argue is perhaps a negative is you find it a little difficult to understand why Danny is able. Like, I mean, obviously he takes some convincing for him to believe that Julian's a killer, because I mean, if anyone told you that, you wouldn't believe them. But after he knows that he is a killer, or has it more or less confirmed, I kind of like, well, would you help him and still be friends? I mean, you'd be scared of him. But I'm not sure I quite buy into the fact that Danny would be like, I'm not affected by these murders, so it's fine for them to happen as long as...
It could maybe be that because of the way Danny's set up at the start, he's very, very safe and normal and quite not timid, but you know, he's not timid or emasculated, but he's not as overtly masculine.
Yeah.
When you see his home life at the start and you see him and Bean like almost have sex before the tree falls through the front of their house or through their kitchen.
Yeah.
It's done in a very kind of all the sexuality with Julian is quite aggressive and predatory, whereas the almost sex scene between Danny and Bean is kind of like comedy and like, oh, are we gonna, oh, you know, and
it's kind of that long marriage of maybe perhaps the...
It's a bit jokey, yeah. And you know, there's none of the animalistic stuff that there is with Julian. And I think the reason that Danny accepts what Julian does and then sticks to him after, you know, the whole scene where Julian demonstrates what he does, it would be terrifying.
Terrified, but yeah. he maybe wants the excitement.
It gives him a thrill, and he's like, you know, now this, like, and, you know, this obviously comes into play later on because it skips ahead 6 months, and then when we're reintroduced to Danny again, he's got a moustache.
Yeah, he's taken the story of Julian on board, and it's a part of him, and it's something he obviously has an affection for. And I guess it is that he sees in Julian a more exciting person who's something he couldn't be, but you know, maybe he goes along with it because he feels like his life is a bit too, you know, boring perhaps. So I think they convey that. So
I'm going to get onto wearing the mustache in a minute, but I also get the impression that Danny doesn't actually have any friends.
Yeah, I mean, he's got work colleagues, but maybe he is a bit lonely. He's got his wife, which I think is something that is kind of what keeps him going, is the fact that he's in a happy marriage, and Julian has never had that, and it's kind of that's where Julian kind of would look up to Danny a bit and see this like perfect, like, you've succeeded, you've done life properly, and you know, you've got each other, and I'm just alone. So but mustaches,
the mustache, which is the giant symbol for masculinity that I love and enjoy in the Matador.
True enough. And Brosnan looks really shady and awesome with his mustache. He's got kind of interesting going grey, like semi buzz cut on the sides, and I love the look of Julian. We haven't really talked about what they look like, and he has this weird orange jacket that he wears a lot, and he's just. I know, he looks like the world is his vacation.
He's like Magnum PI's seedy brother who he doesn't really talk about.
Yeah, yeah. And then
like Magnum's
and then,
kind of ashamed of him.
Exactly. And Danny's a bit more plain than like any like polo neck wearing businessman would be. Like, he's kind of typically glasses wearing, and you know, looks like a regular schmo. And it's just once he's met Julian and has kind of a time has passed, and he's trying to take that little bit of Julian, and the way that it's conveyed to us is through this mustache that it's not as good as Julian's. Like, it's a little more pathetic, and like, I don't know, like sort of second rate cop mustache going on. But you think it's a potent symbolism, do you, Abby?
Well, later on in the movie, we discover that Danny asked Julian to kill someone, but that Julian refused, and he cited reasons that wasn't the kind of man that he really was, and that he wouldn't want that. And then there's other things that they did in Mexico where they discussed manhood and that kind of thing. And when he's finally taken all this in, 6 months later, he has a mustache and he's making love to his wife differently. And he's generally more of a man. Because
he still retains that element of, like, he's trying to be more of a man, but there's still a comedy streak there. Like when he's having sex with his wife on the washing machine and his glasses have steamed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's it's all a bit clumsy and like he's trying really hard to be Julian.
Yeah. But not like stalkerishly, but just sort of he's assimilated a little bit and learned from Julian. He's kind of it's a two-way thing for both of them in many ways. But we got as far as that when Julian explains what he is, and he proves it with a sort of a psych out hypothetical, how would you kill this guy scenario, and he shows him how he might do it, and pulls in Danny to the point where Danny's thinking he's actually going to do this, like arbitrarily kill a random man, and at the last moment Julian's like, no, I got you, I'm not sick, what's wrong with you, you know. and then that kind of sells Danny on this guy might genuinely be what he says he is. And like you say, we skip 6 years and
6 months.
Yeah, we skip 6 months and we see the changes we've just mentioned: the mustache, the personality changes. And meanwhile, Julian has been having a bit of a crisis. I think things tick over for 6 months. We're shown his life in a montage with the awesome like music by Tom Jones over, and we're just shown clips. He's like he's with more women, more contract killings, trotting the globe, and. And then it kind of comes to a head where he has a problem, doesn't he, with one, like I think it's in Moscow. He has
Budapest.
Oh, yeah. With Binky, of course. So, yeah, well, you know, what happens, guys, at that point?
Well, this is the first time he admits that he has a problem to his...
handler, as they
call it. Yeah.
I'm never sure how I feel about... movies telling me the terminology for crimes that you're never going to know about in real life. It's like, do hitmen actually have handlers? Yeah, is it this formal? Do they call them that? Are they cleaners? What's the terminology they actually use?
It's sort of a, you know, we could tell you anything. You're never going to know. he says that he's getting shaky and he needs a break, and his handler basically says, well, you take a break, you might never come back. And the idea is set up that if he screws up too badly, you know, his life will then be on the line.
In a world of hitmen, you know, if a hitman isn't needed, they can be hit by a man. That doesn't make sense. But, you know, in a world where people are disposed of by a murder, you know, it's not so you can't just take the golden watch and go into retirement early.
Well, he says there's no retirement home for hitmen.
But it did sound good. Julian suspects that there could be one, and he suggests that they might have archery at 3 and shooting at 4 or whatever he says. And I like this world. It's almost like where The Prisoner is set, is this world of like ex-assassin old people. But that aside, like you say, it's basically you have to keep going even though you're burnt out and you're worn and you're having like problems that are affecting you doing your job. And he has to snipe someone in Budapest, and it he just can't, and he lets the guy go, and then he gets into trouble, and that kind of forces him back into Danny's life, isn't it?
Yeah, he turns up at Danny's house
at 11 o'clock or 11:30 in the night.
Yeah.
Unexpectedly. I always like awkward strangers I met on a holiday that was particularly weird to just turn up and be like, hey.
Especially ones that you know murder people for money.
Yeah, and you can hear him shouting through the door and being crass, and you're like, there's no way you open this door. And yet, you have to, because he's a madman. You let him in and talk to him rather than let him think you're hiding and he come in and kill you. So it's that weird, there's a fear and a friendship there, I think.
He's that friend you had when you were in school who was kind of like a bully to all the other kids, but for whatever reason liked you. And would like come round your house and break your snares and all, you know.
And you couldn't do anything because they are.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you're not friends, you're enemies. And
yeah, exactly. If you don't let him pull the heads off your wrestling action figures, he'll pull your head off.
Yeah. Do you have a friend like that, Abby? Or were you that friend?
Luckily, my group of friends was small and peaceful.
Yeah.
See, I did, and my mum insisted on inviting him around the house once.
Yeah.
And he basically beat me up for 2 hours while my mum told me to stop showing off.
Yeah, yeah. They always like the person as well. It's always, yeah. Oh, your friend's nice. He's not. He's kind of horrible, but I'm obligated. Yeah, okay.
That's it. That's Julian.
Yeah, but in a way, Danny kind of, even though he's stuck with him and he's a bit intimidated, he still...
He does actually like him.
Yeah, he likes him enough, and I think he's a good enough friend to him that, like, you know, he could have maybe got out of their friendship and it could have been okay, but I think he is polite and he's sympathetic enough.
Yeah.
And it's not too horrible. It's not, like, quite the nightmare, but it is tense at times, and there's always that, like, it could tip the wrong way, and it does frequently. He meets Danny's wife, oddly named but well-acted Bean, and they chat. It seems Bean has been told about a lot of the back history that they had from Mexico, and but not all of it, crucially. But they have an evening of scotch and stories, and it's all going reasonably fine. They eat pie, they play music, they dance, and then it seems Julian has been a bit of a liar and made up a story to get sympathy off of Danny at a time where he'd made the conversation awkward. And what was that, guys?
He lied about having, one, a wife, two, that was dead.
Yeah, he had some sympathy points back by mentioning, oh, I'm sorry for ruining, like, I'm sorry for not being just crass over your son's death, who actually happened. And he gets outed as being a kind of insensitive liar. And, yeah. And again, it nearly escalates out of unforgivable argument. And then, you know, they're drunk enough and sad enough for him that, you know, they just let him stay.
Yeah, this is the thing. This is, like, the power of the performance, I think, with Pierce Brosnan, is, like, even though he's lied about that, you suddenly get really tense thinking, oh, no, I hope they don't kick him out. Like, yeah. he's not really done anything to earn your sympathy at that point.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're like, no, don't kick him out. Let him stay. Because he's so pathetic.
Yeah, you might want them to kind of save Julian from him, his own, like, destructive path of, I don't know, his own problems. They kind of, it's like, yes, be friends and get on and, you know,
help,
kind of
help him.
Yeah, exactly. And what I like about Julian's character is a testament to his horridness is he's forgiven and he stays the night. And then immediately in the morning, he's already, like, pre-planned what, like, he's got the forgiveness and he's booked flights and he's come selfishly for an extra reason. He needs some help, or he thinks he needs some help from Danny. And he's already sorted this. And he wakes Danny up in the morning and sneaks him and gets him to, like, you know, sneak out of the house or whatever. And, like, you've only just won their friendship and you're using him already. It's just frustrating. Do you know what I mean? Do you know the bit I'm on about?
Yeah, when he does the whole, like, sympathy thing and pleads with Danny for help. And then when Danny agrees, he's like, great, flight's already booked. Come on, let's go.
Exactly. It's just, it's already done. He's that underhanded. It's just like, oh, just as we think we're liking you as well, you just do that. And it's like, oh, you. It's back to being a bully again. Not a bully, but that kind of mentality that, like, selfish.
Yeah, like, yeah. As sympathetic and as pathetic as he is, he's also never not going to be selfish.
Yeah.
Well, apart from one gesture at the very end.
Yeah, I guess. So, yeah, basically, we kind of have a bluff that we've spoilt. The movie bluffs us into thinking that their night ended with them falling out, basically, in Mexico and going their separate ways. But what happened, it seems, is I think one of you guys mentioned it was they had a conversation about
Danny had decided he wanted to let Julian kill his business rival, and Julian refused
and talked him out of it. Yeah,
said you'll regret this forever. You, someone like you doesn't need something like that hanging over them.
Yeah, exactly, and that's kind of. And that we don't really know that until later in the film, and that's kind of the surprise, like, oh, I see, there was more to what happened in Mexico.
Yeah, and it adds a whole other, right at the end, adds a whole other dimension to everything that Julian has done from that point.
And makes it a kind of more upbeat and positive ending, I think. It's kind of, it isn't just this tale of one man ruining another man's life.
It's not
whatever.
it's jumping ahead a little bit. Like, it sounds like I'm coming to a conclusion, but it's not as dark a comedy as you think it is when it starts.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree.
And I think it benefits from that.
It was a clever way to do it as well, because you're not constantly trying to guess. It's not one of those films where, oh, I see, there's going to be a twist. It has a twist, but it's a twist you wouldn't know about. And it just puts a little bit of sugar on what could have been quite of a bitter and sad story, I guess. But yeah, basically, in the moment of crisis, the confidence is gone with Julian. He doesn't know if he can do it. He seems to need a guy to drop coffees and open a door at the right time. It's a pretty flimsy reason to get a guy to come with you.
He's got one more job that he has to do, and he's set it up as that if he's been allowed, that if he can pull this job off, he's allowed to retire without being murdered. And yeah, he has this whole setup with... No, because what it is with Danny is that he gets him to open the door to distract the guards so he can cut the wire and get into the door that takes him up to the roof without an alarm going off.
Yeah.
And then he gets him to spill I think it was beer over the guy and bodyguard. So the bodyguard gets up and gives Julian a clear shot.
But the thing with this is, you're a trained, experienced assassin. You can't just do a little distraction. I mean, he could have probably taken the shot anyway. There was other times. It was just that, I almost get the feeling Julian didn't really need him for the things he needed him, got him to do. It's almost like he just wanted a friend again.
Yeah, he needed moral support.
Yeah, so it just seemed like if a fire can do the job, in the demonstration he gives at the bullfight, a bin fire is enough to distract people, to cut a wire. So, well, not to cut a wire in that case, but it's like I got the feeling Julian could have done this anyway. But he's having a crisis, the Freudian mind problems are kicking in, and he wanted a friend, and the only friend he had was a stranger he met, so why not?
Some of the nicest lines referring to that when he shows up in their house in the evening, and he says, "You're the only friend I have, your home is the only home I know."
Yeah, he really opened up in that scene, actually, we kind of glossed over, and
I was just going to say, that sequence where he turns up at the house and the whole time he's there and everything that happens, that's probably my favourite part of the film.
He doesn't even know why he's there. I like that he just... Yeah. Even though he wasn't in tears and frightened, it's the most vulnerable he is literally, "I got nothing." He kind of admits that, straight to them.
Well, that's the thing, is it's got this undercurrent, because obviously you find out later he's turned up there having already booked the flight. So he's turned up because he's going to use Danny.
Yeah.
But the more you learn about him, the more you realise he's not using Danny. He needs him.
Yeah.
He needs his, you were saying, he needs his friend there with him. He doesn't necessarily need him for all those distractions. He just needs him there for support.
Yeah, he wants a friend in his time of problems.
And again, then he has his crisis again and screws up, and then Danny comes to find him, and again, we have probably my second favourite scene, where he finds him crying in a stairwell.
Yeah.
And it was so... The way Pierce Brosnan cried when
a little child.
Yeah, he was. He was like a little boy, and I was like, oh, you are just a mess.
I like it when he was speaking and crying at the same time. He went a little bit Irish. It's oh dear, you are ruined, aren't you?
You're going to stay with me? And you're going to tell me what to do? oh yeah, I'm going to help you. Come on, man. Pull yourself. I like that Danny kind of mans up. And it's like, I may not be able to kill people, but I can tell you and give you the support you need.
I like that we didn't see it happen, though, because that could not go down in any way that wasn't hilarious.
And also, I think, that maybe would have been too funny followed by too brutal. It's kind of, if you showed us that, I think the film would fall apart, because we'd go, oh, come on. When Danny has to talk him into doing it, is he going to be and pull the trigger? Have you got him in your sights? It could, you can't imagine it right. It would just feel like, how can you do this, Danny? You're a normal man. You're helping a guy kill. And I think if we saw it, we wouldn't believe it. But knowing means we can buy into it.
Mm.
So that's kind of the moment before the very end that kind of everything comes together at that point, and then we skip to where Julian has gotten back home in time to...
Well, we find out that the guy he killed as well wasn't a job. It was his boss.
Oh, right, yeah. It was another trick of Julian's. Like, yeah. It's not that I've got a second chance, because it didn't seem like he would get a second chance based on some of the things that transpire. It's just, yeah, I killed the guy who wanted to kill me. Sorted. Don't know if it would be, but we can buy that. But, like, yeah, so at the very end, then, we get Danny's taken back to Denver, is it?
Yes.
Where he's, going to the grave of his son, because it's the anniversary of the son's death, and it's, like, kind of sad, and it's, like... It's kind of... We get a story of Danny and Bean being, like, this couple who are trying to move on with their lives and wanting a new child, and maybe, you know, they've stalled a bit after losing a child. So we have that moment of kind of... like sadness and relief that the story's kind of come to an end, and then, you know, Julian's like in the background, and then the last thing he does is leave he kind of just leaves them like in a lovely shot scene where he's like in the reflection of like a car like wing mirror, and I think you kind of see them all together and yet they're separate.
It's an interesting callback to one of the photos they had in their house where Danny was taking a picture of Bean and their son when he was a baby via the rearview mirror of a car.
Yeah.
It is littered with really nice like direction and flair that just shows you that the people who did this, they cared about it. It was like a well thought out and conceived.
But that was the final gesture that I was talking about. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty positive it's the ticket, isn't it, to Greece that he leaves them.
Yeah, it's like under the wipers he leaves the tickets. Yeah. And it's Greece, I guess, because, I mean, they deserve a holiday, I guess, is the gesture. But Greece is where Julian says he's going to retire to. He wants to go to a little island of Greece and hang out with little Greeks. fill in that however you want. So then that's kind of, and that wraps up the film. It's like a good 90 minutes. It's a nice story, well directed, well planned. I mean, guys, what do you guys think? I mean, what would you say in reflection on it all?
I think it's just so satisfying.
Yeah.
As a filmic experience. It doesn't blow your mind, but so much of it is just done so well that you come out with this tremendous sense of, yes.
Yeah.
Good.
And it's just very kind of, I've struggled really hard to find anything really bad to say about it, like to really pick it apart. Like I really feel like I would have to be setting out to look for things to dislike.
And you don't want to.
No, you'd like it's so, and a lot of it, but it doesn't even, like, superficially you could say that it relies on Pierce Brosnan's performance, which is very good, and he does kind of steal the show.
My favorite moment, by the way, is there's a great scene where he's in a hotel and he's in his pants and like cowboy boots, and he's got like a drink and he's in sunglasses or something, and he's just walking and he looks so insane and cool at the same time, and then he plunges into a swimming pool, like just walks into it,
yeah,
and like
with his beer in his hand as well.
Exactly, yeah.
But no, that's the thing. Like, he does steal the show, but everyone else is really good too. Like, there isn't really a weak link.
No.
It like just happens that he's the largest character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because even, like, Bean doesn't have a whole lot to do, but what she does have to do, she does extremely well.
Yeah, and when he turns up at the house, she really kind of kicks into gear then. Like, she's great in that sequence.
Yeah, because she's kind of intrigued by him as well, and I kind of like her drunk acting as well. When she's drunk, she's just like, she's just brilliant. It's just, I like, I've seen people in that kind of that late night kind of zone, and I think they all nailed the bonding. And if there wasn't that chemistry between all the actors and the characters lining up so nicely, I think it would just be like, what was that, you know? But it was just genuinely done nicely.
I can think of one potential flaw.
Okay, good.
What accent is Pierce Brosnan trying to do?
He's always like, weird with accents, though.
Yeah, like even as James Bond, where you're just like, you know, you're an English spy, and it's like he's going, no, I'm not. And he's doing some weird pseudo-English-Irish thing.
Sounds
and...
a bit like Bowie at times.
Yeah, it's interesting you say Bowie, actually, because Bowie and a lot of other sort of rock stars who tour a great deal, they end up having these transatlantic accents, which are neither one nor the other.
Yeah, I assumed that's what Pierce Brosnan was going for.
Yeah.
Is that he was trying to sound like he's been everywhere a lot.
I know, Brosnan, to me, right, he's Irish, right? So you'd think he could nail an Irish accent. But in the film Taffin, he can't even do Irish. He's like an Irish gangster. He sounds ridiculous. He sounds like an American bad American actor trying to do Irish. It's just like, what? You are this. Like, how is it so wrong? Like, I don't know.
I assumed he was trying to sound like he was from everywhere, which I remember was the excuse that they used for Christopher Lambert in Highlander.
Ah.
not just that he was a bit rubbish and couldn't do accents, but
you've made sense of it though, so you've kind of explained it away in a way.
Yeah, but it is grating at times because he dips so dramatically. Like sometimes he's just like straightforward trying to sound American and doesn't do it very well. And then other times, like I think very early on when he phones somebody who he assumes would be a friend, like telling him it's his birthday, he goes like full on like Cockney.
And I think he's trying to be like he's kind of obnoxious when he's at his friendliest.
Yeah.
He's kind of just awkward and clumsy and not clumsy. He's just the way he talks. He's just like, oh, you doofus. You're kind of an embarrassment.
I think it probably is part of his character's trying too hard all the time.
Yeah.
I also attribute it a little bit to him not knowing who he is.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know, like, am I this sort of Cockney geezer? Am I sort of an American hitman?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think there's an element of plausibility, but if you like the characters, you let that all go and slide entirely. Mm.
Yeah.
So, you know, we tried to think of the bad, but fundamentally, we all really like it. So, I mean, in our final thoughts and rating, we got what can we rate it in? Tricky. Hitmen, terrible coats. I don't know. That orange coat, man, it's quite the look. I don't know. I'm not sure that Julian has. What you got? Mustaches? That should probably be. What mustache is it? Like.
Oh, man.
And our usual spoiler-filled rating that doesn't make any sense and help people out in any way.
This is probably one of the best low-key movies I've seen. You very much have to have the correct temperament for this kind of film. But if you do, you're going to love it.
If you relate to it, I think it seems like at least me and Jamie can relate to some of the characters a bit. I think if you get who they are, you'll enjoy it, and you might if you relate to it, it's going to be a bit what. But fundamentally, I think you're right.
Oh, I'm still trying to think of my mustache. Can Jamie have his final thoughts, then come back to me for a mustache?
Sure thing.
Okay. I think Abby's right in that you do have to have the right kind of temperament for this kind of film. Like, it's not, even though it's a very simple story, and in a lot of ways it is a very universal story because it's about like the development of a relationship and, you know, a kind of midlife crisis, I guess.
Yeah.
The way it's put together is still like, you know, people would have certain expectations that wouldn't be met. You know, they'd expect violence, they'd expect maybe very dark comedy or maybe very broad comedy, of which it doesn't necessarily have either, apart from like every so often. But if you go in with an open mind and, you know, just willing to take whatever comes at you, it is just a really solid, well put together, well thought out, and very well performed by everybody. Little film, and I think it's a shame that it's been forgotten about, particularly in Pierce Brosnan's career, because I think no one ever seems to quite take Pierce Brosnan seriously.
Yeah, there's lots of films where I think aren't a testament to him. Like The Cromwell's Crown Affair, I think, is a pretty shabby movie. I don't think it's his fault. I just think he's got a bunch. Like, The Tailor of Panama is okay. I think it's probably my favourite Pierce Brosnan movie, though.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I would say, like, this and, like, Goldeneye.
Goldeneye is definitely the... Let's just say it, right? Goldeneye is the best Bond film.
And well, hang on, we're not starting that debate now.
Goldeneye is the best Nintendo 64 Bond.
Okay, but no, it like Pierce Brosnan's problem seems to be he's always wasted. Like, people cast him in something, and then it's like they've forgotten they've put him in there.
Sure.
And he's just like, or he's always in really poorly written films, and he's always.
Anyone? What? Mamma Mia, anyone?
Well, that's just a disaster from the ground up, really. But no, he's like, he's got a lot of charisma, and it's like no one seems to know what to do with him outside of James Bond, or even inside of James Bond. So this film, I think, was perfect for him. Like, he was perfectly cast, and this is like the film that he's needed for so long. And I think it's a shame that nothing really happened after this, apart from Mamma Mia.
Yeah, it's like in his later film career, he stopped being this kind of suave, old, slight, you know, mature, attractive, cool guy, and more of a like eccentric, oddball at times. Like, he's better at characters, I think, and more intriguing when he's a little different and not this kind of cool young guy. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, he's in his old age, he's kind of come into his own for being weirder and more interesting.
A lot of actors get that, though, where they're just sort of, they have to wait to not be quite as good looking anymore. And then they're allowed to do other things.
Yeah.
Okay, so is that it, Jamie, or?
I just think it's a really, really good film, as long as you go in with no particular expectations other than just enjoying it.
Okay. Do we have any mustaches to rate the film? What kind of mustache is this film?
I think I have one. Actually, I'm torn between two, which I wasn't expecting.
Go on.
I'm torn between the putty handlebar and the zapper.
The zapper, right.
Well, basically for the same reason, I just can't pick which one. You know exactly what to expect from the putty handlebar or the zapper. The kind of person who wears that moustache is of a certain character. And you are either going to like that character or you're not.
Okay. I kind of get where you're going.
I'll go with the zapper because I thought of it first.
It's a bit more manly, I think, as well. Well, this film is kind of manly. Jamie, do you have a tash of choice?
Yeah, I'm going to go with something very specific. Okay. It's Nicolas Cage's moustache.
right.
At the times that he has one, because you look at it initially and you think, whoa, what? Because it's Nicolas Cage, but with a moustache. And then after a minute, you're like, but it's Nicolas Cage with a moustache. And then you really enjoy yourself.
True.
I sort of know what you mean.
Like, it takes you by surprise at first, but then you just enjoy it because, you know, everybody, well, maybe not, but I enjoy Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. I think for me, it is that stereotypical cop moustache that they kind of have in the film. And I think Pierce Brosnan's moustache is the movie because at first it's kind of like, oh, Pierce Brosnan, that'll be, you know, an interesting like action movie or something. But what's he doing with that moustache? And that movie is kind of like, the movie catches you by surprise. You're not quite sure what it's going to be. And then you go, oh, that moustache is right. Like, that is spot on. Like, it's kind of, it should be wrong, but it's just so right, you know, given the context. So
it's done so well.
You can pull off the moustache, not literally, although possibly literally. But it's just, you don't expect it to work, I don't think. You're kind of not even sure about it at first, and then you're sold on it, you know?
Yeah.
But hey, you know, basically all I need to say is check it out. Probably should have said that top of the show, because, you know, the spoilers. But you guys covered it. I think we've nailed this one. Check out The Matador, add it to your collection. And keep looking out for Brosnan in weird places. He is a sentinel in a film. Not a sentinel. What are those things called? He's
what you're talking about?
He's got a horse body in like Percy Jackson or something.
Oh,
centaur.
Centaur, yeah.
Yeah, he's a centaur in a thing. He's He gets about. You'll find Pierce Brosnan, and I recommend it because he's an interesting guy. And the other actors, they're good too, so let's not forget about them. Time to say goodbye, though, right, guys?
I think it is, yes.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Bye!
Bye.
Bye.